ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 11th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, a Syrian president, the first to visit the White House in almost 80 years. And on Remembrance Day today, a bush retreat provides quiet mateship for our service men and women.
It doesn't take a real lot for people to become traumatised. In my case, it was a full 40 years and it sneaks up on you. We don't sit down and have big talking sessions about our dramas. You do gradually get rid of some of the incidents that end up bothering you.
50 years ago today, the Government of Australia was dismissed and a caretaker Prime Minister appointed. The Whitlam government remains the only government to have been dismissed by a Governor General in our history. But should it have happened in the first place? In the 50 years since the dismissal, there's been contention over the act itself, which has only grown deeper. Rachel Mealy prepared this report.
We have breaking news now from Canberra.
Let's go live to federal politics reporter Emily Saunders, who's at Parliament House for us now.
If it happened today, there'd be wall-to-wall coverage and notifications on our phones keeping us up to date with every iteration of the story. But on the 11th of the 11th, 1975, Australians learned about the events unfolding in Canberra at different times and in different ways. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was still in primary school.
I was in year seven. My history teacher at the time, Vince Crowe, he burst into the classroom to tell us that our government has been dismissed.
But the former Prime Minister, Paul Keating, was a little closer to the action. He was a junior minister in the Whitlam government and was in Gough Whitlam's inner circle when it happened.
It was, in every respect, a coup. It was a coup by an individual, not a sort of violent gathering, but a coup. And everyone understood, I think, that something wrong had happened.
Former Prime Minister John Howard was a junior shadow minister under the opposition leader Malcolm Fraser.
I was inside the House of Representatives chamber and the bells had begun ringing at 2:10. I approached the then chief opposition whip and he said, Kerr has sacked Gough. And I looked at him rather incredulously. I said, you can't be serious. He said, yes, I am. I remember it very clearly.
Paul Keating says he told Gough Whitlam that the Governor-General was acting outside of his role's boundaries and he should be replaced.
My proposition was that Gough should ask the Queen to accept his advice about the appointment of a new Governor-General, and in the event that Kerr resisted, I said to Gough I thought he should be put under police arrest.
Anthony Albanese says the proper protocols were not followed.
And even Malcolm Fraser looked back and said that things should have been done differently, said that the Governor-General should have consulted properly with the elected Prime Minister, Gough Whitlam.
He says then Prime Minister Gough Whitlam should have known that the Governor-General had spoken to the opposition leader Malcolm Fraser and that he was at Government House when he visited.
The fact that both Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser were in Government House at Yarralumla, not to the knowledge of the elected Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, I think shows that it was an entirely inappropriate action.
John Howard says he felt for Governor-General Sir John Kerr and the pressure he was under.
I felt very sympathetic towards Kerr. I felt that he was the meat in the sandwich between two very powerful, determined men who each behaved in their own way in a very ruthless fashion. I felt that the action Kerr took was the only one that could have resolved the situation absent either Fraser backing down in blocking supply or Whitlam advising a general election for both houses of parliament.
But while the dismissal played out in political circles, it was a family affair as well. Gough Whitlam's eldest son, Tony, was in London when he heard of the day's events.
My sleep was disrupted on the Tuesday morning when I got a call from my mother. And she told me Gough's been dismissed. And, well, you know, I've been following from afar developments here, but I never thought it would come to it. So it must have been, I should think, probably about 4 a.m. in the morning there. So naturally I didn't return to sleep, and I used to get up and go for a run around Hyde Park in the mornings, and so I maintained that routine and thought it all through, you know, and did every permutation in my head that I could.
Gough Whitlam's eldest son, Tony, ending that report by Rachel Mealy. Well, as you just heard, views on the dismissal depend on which side of politics you ask. It's either a tragic robbing of legitimate elected power or an end-stage government inept and on the nose. One historian says the extraordinary drama of that day can sometimes overshadow the achievements of Gough Whitlam's government, which in some ways shaped Australia more than that fateful day 50 years ago today. Professor of History Michelle Arrow is also the president of the Australian Historical Association, and she's a professor of history at Macquarie University. She joined me earlier. Professor, in 1972, Gough Whitlam outlined his three great aims. They were to promote equality, to involve the people in decision-making, and to liberate the talents and uplift the horizons of the Australian people. In what ways did he promote equality, in your view?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Labor Party in the late 60s and early 1970s is that they were really trying to broaden out the conception of who a Labor voter could be. Labor had always represented voting people, but really that meant a focus on white male breadwinners. And I think one of the things that Labor did in that process of winning government in 1972 is identify different kinds of voters that were also deserving of the same kinds of representation and opportunities that, you know, their core demographic was. And so one of the things I think that Labor does to promote equality, they recognise women beyond the home. They're kind of representing working women and looking to improve things like equal pay, minimum wages, childcare, things like that. The official recognition of the kind of end of the age of assimilation, I think, is really, really important. The Fraser government implements a lot of the infrastructure around what was called the new policy of multiculturalism. They also did things like recognise Aboriginal land rights, which was a hugely important move. And of course, again, some of those initial legislation was finally passed by the Fraser government, but it was the Whitlam government that kind of introduced those changes. It also passed the landmark Racial Discrimination Act in 1975. So I think just in a few of those, you can kind of see the ways that they're looking to recognise different kinds of inequality and promote new kinds of equality for different kinds of citizens. And so that was really groundbreaking in the early 1970s.
His administration took a what-do-you-think approach on the involvement of people in decision-making, didn't he? And he also had this idea of uplifting the horizons of the Australian people. How do you think he achieved those two aims?
The idea of involving people in decision-making and government was sort of about broadening the kinds of expertise that governments would listen to when they were making policy. I mean, one good example of that is in relation to women. There were no female MPs in the first Whitlam government, but Whitlam employed a women's affairs advisor who was the first advisor to a national government in the world in that role. The Royal Commission on Human Relationships literally asked people, what do you think about family life, about sexuality, childcare, family? All those kinds of things were about establishing the idea that people deserved some kind of say in the policies that would affect their lives. And in terms of liberating the talents and uplifting the horizons of people, this took on a number of forms. I think partly you can see in things like education funding. Whitlam was very preoccupied with kind of boosting public education funding, expanding preschools rather than establishing them. Abolishing university fees is one of the most well-remembered acts, which kind of meant that so many people, particularly women who had married young and were not able to access tertiary education, could go to university for free. But it was also about arts policy. It was about things like changing our national anthem from God Save the Queen to Advance Australia Fair. So there were all kinds of things that related to trying to craft a more assertive version of Australian national identity. And that was reflected in arts policy, in foreign policy, in education, and many other aspects of his government as well.
So on this 50th anniversary of the dismissal, when you weigh up the value he brought to the Australian public and society versus the manner in which he was removed, how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's also important to keep in mind that there were a lot of scandals, there were problems within the Whitlam government that kind of partly contributed to, of course, the way that the dismissal happened. But I think people remember the government very fondly. And when Whitlam died in 2014, people could list all the things that they felt that Whitlam's government had improved their lives. But I think, too, the way the Whitlam government governed, I think, has really shaped the way that subsequent governments have approached the task of governing as well. And so it casts a very long shadow over our contemporary political life. But it also, in fact, in a lot of ways, created the sorts of rights and freedoms and relationships to government that we all still kind of have certain expectations around today.
Professor of History at Macquarie University, Michelle Arrow, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all of our stories. Just search for The World Today. Overseas now, and at least 8 people have been killed and around 20 others injured after a car exploded in the Indian capital of New Delhi. Authorities say they're investigating all possibilities, with major centres in the country put on high alert after the blast. Here's Tanya Dendrinos.
Panic and frenzy in a densely populated New Delhi district. Large flames billowed after a car exploded near a metro station close to the Red Fort, one of the capital's most high-profile landmarks. This man says the blast occurred only slightly ahead of him. I'm not sure what it was, a bomb or I don't know what, he says. Another man says he heard the explosion and came running.
We looked around and we didn't go close out of fear. We saw a body part lying there. It seemed as if it was completely blown up. Then I saw another body part. I can't express how big the blast was.
Ambulance drivers recall a similar scene, saying they collected both bodies and body parts from the site surrounding the explosion. Amit Shah, India's interior minister, says the blast occurred when a slow-moving car stopped at a traffic light near the historic Red Fort complex, which is a UNESCO World Heritage site. The car involved in the blast, a Hyundai i20.
We are investigating the incident and exploring all the possibilities. We will share the results with the public after a thorough investigation.
Satish Golcha is New Delhi's police commissioner.
There were passengers inside the vehicle during the explosion, which also damaged other vehicles nearby. As soon as we got the call, all agencies, including Delhi Police, Forensics, the National Security Guard and the National Investigation Agency, began taking stock of the situation.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi offered his condolences on social media, as did Australia's High Commissioner to India. Transport hubs, including airports and train stations, as well as government buildings across India, were put on high alert after the blast, as forensic teams gathered what they could from the scene. People gathered outside a local hospital, where some of the injured were being treated, loved ones anxiously awaiting news. A hospital representative telling local media some sustained serious injuries. The Australian government's smart traveller site urges a high degree of caution for travellers to India, today updating its advisory acknowledging the explosion, saying anyone in the area should follow the advice of local authorities.
Tanya Dendrinos. Well, after years of isolation and war, Syria is coming in from the cold. Syria's President Ahmed al-Shara has met US President Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. It is the first official visit by a Syrian president to the White House in almost 80 years. But at home, the country is still deeply divided, and some communities fear Syria's transitional government won't protect them. Here's Nicole Johnston.
Syria is capitalising on its all-American welcome. President Ahmed al-Shara joining 2 senior US military officials for a game of basketball. Al-Shara scores, but he has one major goal on his mind for this US trip, and that is getting sanctions lifted. Mr. Trump has suspended some of them for 6 months, but not all. Joshua Landis is director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma.
What Shara needs is for the Congress to lift the Caesar sanctions, which are devastating because they make it criminal for any international company to do business in Syria.
Does it appear they'll be lifted?
Well, the Senate has already passed a bill saying that they will lift them, but the House has not. The minorities in Syria who've faced massacre, the Alawites in March, the Druze in July faced massacres from this new government. They are lobbying Congress not to do this. So are Christians.
Speaking from the Oval Office, President Trump had plenty of praise for Mr. al-Sharaa.
Well, I've had an agreement with him. He's a very strong leader. He comes from a very tough place, and he's a tough guy. I liked him. I get along with him.
During Syria's 14-year-long civil war, Ahmed al-Sharaa was designated as a terrorist by the US and the UN, with a $10 million US bounty on his head. He led a group which had links to al-Qaeda. But since defeating the previous regime of Bashar al-Assad and sweeping to power last year, Mr. al-Sharaa says he's been reformed.
He's certainly moderated Syria's foreign policy. That is for sure. He has no ambitions, as he says, for any international jihad. And the revolution is over, he told all of his Arab neighbors. I'm not trying to export it. The trouble is that Syria's minorities, which are 30% of the country, whether it's Kurds, Druze, Alawites, Christians, are all very fearful.
And divided. Karim Shah is a Syrian economist. He was visiting Damascus last week and now lives in New Zealand.
I feel very happy. I feel optimistic about the outlook for Syria. It's great to see Syria opening up to the West. This is a visit that we've not seen since the mid-1940s, you know, of a Syrian president to the United States. And I think the signs look promising.
In Syria's northern city of Aleppo, Ismail al-Abdullah is waiting for change.
People still, they want to return to their homes. Still, the camps are in the north, more than 3 million people in the camps. They want to get back to their homes, rebuild their homes, education. Thousands of children drop out of the school. We want them to get back to their schools.
Aleppo resident Ismail al-Abdullah, ending that report by Nicole Johnston. Doctors say women experiencing menopause are being scared off from accessing potentially life-changing treatments because of exaggerated risks to their health. It comes as the United States medical regulator announced it wants to remove several health risk warnings from hormonal therapy products for menopause. Medical experts in Australia have welcomed the decision, saying the health warnings are based on outdated advice and that hormone treatment is safe for most women. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
For Sonia Lovell, menopause was sudden. It began when she started chemotherapy after she was diagnosed with breast cancer at 47.
It was very, very challenging and very difficult to navigate.
Her symptoms were debilitating and she was eventually prescribed menopause hormone therapy.
Suddenly I was lighter and brighter and happier. I didn't suffer anxiety anymore. You know, I just was really able to enjoy my life a whole lot more.
While it was the right move for her, she says as the host of the Dear Menopause podcast, she's heard many stories of women sceptical about the use of hormone therapies due to health warnings.
They'll take it home, they'll read the sheet, and then they will never use it because the fear of what is in that information sheet overwhelms them.
This week, the United States medicines regulator, the Food and Drug Administration, announced it wants to remove warnings for breast cancer and cardiovascular disease from hormone replacement therapy or HRT products for menopause, and will likely remove references to risk of dementia. But a warning for endometrial cancer risk will remain. The FDA says current warnings are based on a large-scale 2002 study, the Women's Health Initiative, but more recent research shows such treatments are generally safe. Sonia Lovell says it's a welcome development.
Oh, thank God. Hallelujah. It has been a very exciting morning.
And medical experts agree, saying it's time Australia's regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, reviews similar warnings.
The data to suggest that menopausal hormonal therapy is linked to breast cancer and cardiovascular disease is really lacking.
Dr. Heather Waterfall is the chair of the Private Practice Committee with the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists.
We really think those warnings have been over-exaggerated, and removal of the warnings, I think, is an excellent thing for women.
Dr. Waterfall says the current warnings have led to her own patients refusing treatment.
In particular for vaginal estrogen, which has very, very little whole body absorption. And I'll say to women, oh, I think you need it for this reason. And they'll go and go, okay, yeah, sure, the doctor's recommended it. Then they'll go and get it from the pharmacy. And as soon as they see that this product can increase your risk of breast cancer, they put it back on the shelf and say, no, I'm not going to use that.
Magdalena Simonis is a clinical associate professor with the Department of General Practice at the University of Melbourne and a spokesperson for the Australian Medical Association. She says a majority of women don't seek treatment for menopause symptoms.
Of the, let's say, 50 to 60% of women who have significant symptoms warranting some treatment, probably somewhere in the order of around 10% have been receiving treatment to date.
Magdalena Simonis says women should talk to their doctors about what's suitable for them.
What we do know from the existing research is that hormone therapy in select candidates where, you know, they have a good relationship with their doctor is really life-changing and provides enormous benefits both for the short-term and the long-term in terms of other disease prevention.
In a statement, a spokesman for the Therapeutic Goods Administration says the TGA is aware of the FDA proposed changes to product labelling and will independently consider the data that's been used to support its amendments.
Bridget Fitzgerald and Kimberly Price with that report. It's Remembrance Day today, with hundreds gathering to observe a minute's silence at war memorials around the country. The last post being played at the nation's war memorial in Canberra this morning to mark the anniversary of the end of World War I. And veterans organisations today are urging us to check in on our service men and women. Near Rockhampton, a special retreat has been operating for about 30 years by a psychologist who dreamt up a place where veterans could visit when things were getting tough. Vanessa Jarrett headed along to find out the power of working bees and mateship.
It's tools down at the Coxcomb Veterans Bush Retreat's weekly working bee, and lunch is ready to be served.
It's a place where camaraderie, yeah, and you come and most of the time you don't talk about your experiences. Sometimes you do if you know, blokes having a bit of a downer.
Ronald Robinson served in the Royal Australian Air Force as a telegraphist, specialising in Morse code. He's been coming to this property for 17 years, nestled in the foothills of Mount Gaye at Kawarral, about 30 kilometres from Rockhampton in central Queensland. It became the Coxcomb Veterans Bush Retreat in 1997, founded by the late Bruce Ackett.
He had about an 80-acre block. Bruce Ackett, which this is named after, was our psychologist, and he donated the land to us, had it cut off from the main block.
Every Tuesday, the members come together for a bite to eat and to do odd jobs around the property, which also provide opportunities for veterans to connect. Vietnam vet Colin Beaton has been coming here from the beginning.
It's a place where you can come and have a yarn and more or less forget about it sort of thing. Yeah. We don't talk about Vietnam or anything, you know what I mean? We just love being here.
It's had such a positive impact on him. He wants the next generation of veterans to have the same support.
I like to see a lot of young fellows from Iraq and all them, you know, Afghanistan. Yeah, I'd like to see them join up and come along, because out there we've got a place for them, and yeah, it'd be great.
How do you think it would help them?
Immensely.
With dongas and cabins for travellers, there's plenty of maintenance work to keep the veterans going. And emergency service personnel are welcome too. Gary Semple used to bring his dad, who was ex-military.
It flowed on that the camp was available to first responders, and eventually I found the need to frequent here on a Tuesday in particular.
After 40 years as a firefighter in Yeppoon in Queensland, he benefits from the camp now too.
It doesn't take a real lot for people to become traumatised and suffer whatever they're told they're suffering from. In my case, it was a full 40 years or almost, and it sneaks up on you.
They're not here to swap war stories. Instead, it's an opportunity for mateship. Bob Holmes, is the group president.
And if someone's got a problem or they want to know something about DVA and someone might know something, how they can do it.
In recent years, government grants have allowed the volunteers to expand. The camp now has a museum filled with military memorabilia. Mr. Holmes says the group is keen to welcome younger members and ensure the support is there for them too.
As they get older, they're going to find that things will start coming back to them that they've seen and they'll need somewhere.
The president of the Coxcomb Veterans Bush Retreat, Bob Holmes, ending that report by Vanessa Jarrett. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 3 hours of free electricity in the middle of the day sounds pretty good. But is the federal government's latest solar offer going to reduce hefty power bills? Or is there a catch? Today, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, Alison Reeve, unpacks the ups and downs of the scheme. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.